Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CPR Podcast. My name is Mike Barrow, and today we're going to talk about syncope. Syncope is one of those super ambiguous complaints, like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, chest discomfort, extremely vague. And there's a lot of investigation that we need to do when it comes to treating the syncopal patients. So I'm going to talk about some of the common pitfalls that we fall into in pre-hospital care. First of all, I want to start off with some definitions. According to Tinelli's Emergency Medicine Manual, and I'm going to quote directly from that, syncope is a transient loss of consciousness accompanied by loss of postural tone, followed by complete resolution without intervention. In contrast, you look at Merck Manual, and you find that near syncope is lightheadedness and a sense of impending fainting without loss of consciousness. However, I'm going to start off the show by telling you that the differentiation between the two is complete and utter bullshit. Near syncope and syncope are the same thing. Period. End of statement. And in the pre-hospital system, in the pre-hospital setting, in the emergency department setting, we have got to start screening both near syncopal and syncopal patients the exact same way. One does not outrank the other. So for the purposes of this podcast, I'm not going to differentiate between near syncope and syncope, even if it's near syncope or dizziness. I'm going to be referring to it as syncope. So just so there's no confusion, that's where we're starting. Syncope is one of those topics that actually exposes our ignorance and truthfully our laziness. One of my mentors has actually coined a phrase that I absolutely have fallen in love with. And it's that it's not our patient's job to prove that they're sick. It's our job to prove that they're not. So when that 3 a.m. abdominal pain calls you, you need to run through your list of differential diagnoses. It could just be a gas bubble for all you know. But the fact of the matter is our job to ask the right questions, run the right diagnostics, and come to the right conclusion, or at least be in the ballpark of the right conclusion. And truthfully, syncope is one of those areas where we just don't do it well. I'm throwing myself in that category too. Are there non-fatal causes of syncope? Absolutely, there are. Are we going to talk about some of them? Yeah, we'll talk about a couple. But we're going to really focus very heavily, especially on the cardiac causes of syncope during this episode. As you found in episode 22, we talked about differentiating between vestibular neuritis and the posterior infarction. We're not really good at that still. But the fact of the matter is that we also need to start investigating the cardiac causes of those types of symptoms as well. So we're going to get into that. First, we're going to talk about a couple of the non-fatal causes of syncope, because I think it would be irresponsible to not talk about those too. So we're going to start off with situational syncope, and that's pretty much fainting during urination. There's usually associated with a severe drop in blood pressure. You've got widespread vasodilation, typically from rapid bladder emptying. It's more common in older men than it is women. Primary parties that are affected of it are chronic E2H users, dehydrated parties, and patients who use alpha blockers for prostate problems. The fact of the matter is that situational syncope, while it might get you an admission, it usually won't. It's fairly benign. You know, if you don't have any significant comorbidities, chances are that patient's not going to get admitted. Then we have our vasovagal syncope. This is tied into more of an emotional or external stressor. It's often likened to pseudo-seizure activity. It can be caused by things like pain or having your blood drawn or being overheated or rapidly changing positions, going from sitting to standing to sitting to standing, back and forth like that. Once again, really benign. The fact of the matter is unless you have other significant comorbidities, you're probably not going to get admitted. You're going to get screened. You're going to have an EKG. You're going to get some labs done. Most of the time, this is going to be the person that gets discharged from the emergency department after a syncopal episode. Once again, another quick and dirty guide to another fairly benign form of syncope. However, it's not always benign. This one starts to get a little bit more serious depending on the degree of it. We've got postural hypotension and syncope. Hypovolemia is a cause of syncope, and we'd be, like I said, irresponsible not to include that. But, you know, you can usually kind of tell that this is where your treatment modality is going to go. A quick note that I would like to point out. For the love of God, stop doing orthostatic vital signs. Just stop. There is a ton of literature about how orthostatic vital signs are not accurate. Corey M. did a fantastic video presentation on the myth of orthostatic vital signs. It's linked in the show notes. If you haven't checked it out already, please go check it out. It completely debunks everything that we hold dear about the dogma of orthostatic vital signs. It doesn't work. Stop putting your patients through undue misery for something that you can tell by skin color, by assessment. The fact of the matter is, if somebody has a good story for hypovolemia, they're probably hypovolemic. And the fact of the matter is, if they're going from lying down to barely sitting up and they're starting to feel those symptoms, they're probably hypovolemic. Give them some fluid. So moving forward here, I'm going to start talking about more of the technicalities that are involved. For reasons that we're going to get into later, it's really, really, really important for especially pediatric patients for you to be able to determine if they actually had a syncopal episode or not. So it's no secret to anybody that's been doing this for any period of time that your pediatric syncope patient could very well just be a breath-holding spell. So get some history from mom and dad or babysitter or guardian or whoever's with this kid. Were they pissed off? Did they turn colors? Were they just holding their breath? What's going on? Another thing that you need to be able to differentiate between is the concurrence of syncope or seizures. Once again, there's some really interesting literature that's out there. There's a 2003 study in the British Medical Journal that highlighted the fact that syncope patients typically, not always, but the majority of the time, don't have a concurrent seizure history. In fact, out of the 797 syncopal patients that were interviewed, only 3 of them had a seizure history. In fact, 20% of patients that were brought in for what was deemed to be initially as an epileptic episode were actually found to have a cardiac cause of syncope. So a couple of the things that we talk about in pre-hospital care, once again, exploring a little bit of the dogma that we continue to perpetuate, is that, well, they passed out, they wet their pants, and they're acting a little goofy. They're probably postictal. Well, great. The fact of the matter is that with syncopal episodes, you can also have a little bit of tremulous activity. You can shake. You can look like you're seizing. And you can also have a loss of bladder during a syncopal episode. The big thing that you need to be able to differentiate between the two is understanding the fact that, you know, your patient might have risk factors for a seizure episode versus a syncopal episode. So somebody is preeclamptic or eclamptic, prone to hypoglycemia, or actually has an epileptic history, chances are they probably didn't have a syncopal episode. They probably had a seizure. But if your patient doesn't have a set of risk factors for seizure activity, this is probably a syncopal episode. So just a couple things to consider there. So when we actually start breaking down the cardiac causes of syncope, there are a couple fantastic resources that are out there. Obviously, we're really biased, but we really enjoy the podcast and blog venue. And one of the podcasts that I was listening to recently was the EM Clerkship podcast. They did an episode on syncope a little while ago. One of the things that they covered during that podcast is what they called the QT Bride mnemonic. So under that first mnemonic category, you have QT prolongation. And like most of us already know, the primary cause of QT prolongation is going to be electrolyte imbalance, especially hypokalemia, hypomagnesia, and hypocalcemia. Another main factor for QT prolongation is going to be the presence of an AMI. There are a lot of different medication profiles that certainly contribute to QT prolongation, like different types of antipsychotics, antidysrhythmics, especially like amiodarone, procainamide, different antihistamines, and then also obviously your tricyclic antidepressants. So for the majority of the time, your adult patients, men are going to have slightly shorter QT than your female patients. So according to several different sources, you're going to have some varied times between the two. But for the most part, it's going to be about 360 milliseconds to 440 milliseconds for your adult males, and then about 360 to 460 for your female patients. So why are we concerned about QT prolongation and syncope? There's some pretty convincing literature that we have linked in the show notes. It talks about the prevalence and the increased risk for ventricular dysrhythmias like VFib, VTach, and torsades de Pointe with QT prolongation. So once again, nothing really new. The next portion of the QT bride mnemonic is going to be Brugada syndrome. And when we actually look at the prevalence of Brugada, approximately the ratio of people that you're going to find that in is about 5 out of 100,000 people. You're most going to be looking at this for infants, young adults, people usually under about 40 years of age, depending on demographics. People of Southeastern Asian descent and occasionally African American descent can actually be probably your more highly likely population that's going to be noticeable with this. So according to National Health Institute, Brugada syndrome is a condition that causes a disruption of the heart's normal rhythm, specifically a disorder that can lead to irregular heartbeats in the heart's lower chambers, especially the ventricles. So it's essentially a type of ventricular arrhythmia. When you're looking at identification for Brugada, you're going to notice kind of a weird looking ST elevation. So you're going to notice it's described in the literature as pretty much kind of a coved shape. So for the fat kid that I am, when I think of that coved shape, I think of Arby's hash browns. True story. It's that triangular, kind of that rounded triangular shape. So you're going to see about probably greater than 2 millimeters of elevation in V1 through 3. There are a couple pictures in the show notes that demonstrate this type of finding on your 12 lead. And for me being a more visual person, I would highly suggest it. When you're looking at definitive treatment for Brugada, it's going to be pretty much AICD placement. The majority of the time, unfortunately, when people have actually had some sort of episode or exacerbation of this, it's actually a fairly fatal arrhythmia. So we need to be proactive in screening our patients for it. Moving on to the R portion, right heart strain. The most common causes of right heart strain are going to be primarily your pulmonary emboli, pulmonary hypertension, cor pulmonale, and then arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathies. When I think of right heart failure, I like to deem this the Justin Bieber effect. And that's where essentially you have something that's not used to getting a lot of attention, not handle attention very well when it finally gets it. Hence, the right side of the heart. When you're looking at the right side of the heart, typically the left heart is the main pump. However, due to some sort of underlying pathology, the right heart becomes overloaded. And when you're looking at this, you're going to be finding some interesting things on your 12 lead. Typically, right heart strain patterns are going to manifest with T-wave inversion or ST depression in V1 through 4. So really kind of that anterior septal area that really kind of shows the differentiation between the ventricles there. It's going to show that they're being overworked. So right heart strain, absolutely a source of syncope. Ischemia and infarction. Once again here, I'm going to have a bit of a stroke because out of the studies that were conducted, there is a differentiation between the prevalence of AMI during syncope and then as well as near syncope. However, like I said before, and if you take nothing else away from this, the two should be treated the same. So a 2009 study in the Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine discussed the prevalence of classic syncope, so actual loss of consciousness, in the presence of an AMI. Out of the 1,474 patients that were monitored, only 42 were actually diagnosed with an AMI. So that's about 0.03%. So not a high likelihood of actually having that classic syncope. What's even more fascinating about this study is that out of those 42 patients that were actually diagnosed with an AMI, 37 of those 42 were actually non-STEMIs. So in contrast to that study, there is also a 2000 study that came in the European Journal of Clinical Investigation that yielded a 13% likelihood of near syncope in patients that were evaluated during an AMI. So pretty markedly different findings. The biggest takeaway that I got from reading through those two studies was that the prevalence of non-STEMIs during syncope was actually markedly higher than those with STEMIs. So definitely something to consider with somebody that's having those classic ACS symptoms that also experiences syncope. So moving on from ischemia and infarction to delta waves. When you're thinking of delta waves, the first thought that I typically have is going to be Wolff-Parkinson-White. So that's going to be pretty much just kind of that upslope, that triangular upslope going into your QRS complex. So it's going to be kind of coved. It can be positive. It can be negative deflection. It doesn't really matter. But a couple of things that you want to be conscientious of with primarily Wolff-Parkinson-White, like I said, that's probably going to be your most common cause for those delta waves, is actually being able to identify that. When you have Wolff-Parkinson-White, especially with comorbidities of atrial fibrillation, there are some problems that can happen. Because what happens in EMS when somebody's symptomatic, complaining of palpitations, complaining of chest discomfort, shortness of breath, they're super tachycardic, they're kind of hypotensive, we treat them primarily for that SVT at first. And depending on the rate, it might be damn near impossible to actually tell if it's regular or not. So what's the old adage? Let's give a trial of adenosine. But there have been several documented cases of practitioners giving patients with WPW with an underlying AFib presentation adenosine and actually sending them into VFib, VTAC, cardiac arrest. About 10% of the EKGs that were initially diagnosed as SVT, primarily in pediatrics, were actually AFib with WPW. So just be cognizant of that. The last part of this mnemonic is epsilon waves. So when we talked about that right heart strain, you've got the leading cause of epsilon waves. It's actually going to be that arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. So it's not always going to present with the epsilon waves. In fact, a lot of the time, it's actually going to be fairly symptomatic and a new diagnosis of a bundle branch block, very similar to pulmonary emboli. Syncope is the primary symptom for arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. And for those of you who are wondering what the hell it is, it's essentially where, for some reason, the right ventricle, the muscle of the right ventricle, has been basically replaced by adipose tissue. And it's just kind of that floppy, ineffective right heart, which leads to right heart failure. Now that we're done with the QT bride mnemonic, we're going to talk about tachydysrhythmias and syncope. An amazing podcast that I recently listened to was by Emergency Medicine Cases, and it talked about different types of adult and pediatric syncope. And one of the things that was pointed out during that podcast was just how rare SVT really is, true SVT in syncope. And truthfully, I think that the majority of the time when we hear chest discomfort, palpitations, syncope, almost every pre-hospital provider goes to SVT. However, really one of the things that we've got to focus on is that that's actually a really rare occurrence in true syncope. In fact, one of the more common occurrences is going to be a new onset of a flutter or a fib. And you also have to think about some of the different complications that you're going to face with that. I mean, the formation of clots, especially in the right side of the heart with pulmonary emboli and CHF patterns and that right heart strain. So there is a pretty high likelihood that for that syncope patient, you might start seeing some actual right heart strain in concurrence with a flutter or a fib. Another thing that I wanted to just briefly touch on is the occurrence of ventricular fibrillation in syncope. The first time I heard it, I thought it was bullshit. I've been using that word a lot lately. I'm sorry for those of you that are offended by that. I should probably stop. But the fact of the matter is that there are some patients that can present with syncope and V-fib and still be alive and not in cardiac arrest. So when you're looking at these patients, these are going to be your VAD patients, and it's because they have that augmented left ventricular flow. So there's an amazing video that we put a link to in the show notes that actually shows an ultrasound of a VAD patient in VF that is actually still alive. So just something to consider. So moving along to bradydysrhythmias and syncope. There's a 1997 German study that revealed approximately 3 to 10%, yes, that is a wide margin of error, 3 to 10% of syncope patients that were evaluated in the EDs that were being studied experienced syncope as a result of bradycardia. So when we actually start to break down the more common types of bradycardia, you know, for adults, you've got to think ischemia. You can absolutely have some of that those pharmacokinetics that are in the making. So your beta and your calcium channel blocker overdoses, your DIG toxicity, your amiodarone toxicity. For kids, it's simple, hypoxia. Hypoxia is the reason the kids become bradycardic. Additionally, for primarily your adults, your electrolyte imbalances, your hypohyperkalemia, hypocalcemia, increased vagal tone for your adults. And then another just kind of oddity that I found really interesting is when we're actually researching this topic, the prevalence of sixth sinus syndrome, not just in your geriatric patients, but in your kids with Down syndrome and tetralogy. So just a little fun fact there. You're probably going to be looking for the zebra instead of the horse when you hear the horse hooves, but just something to kind of throw in the back of your head. When you actually look at simple bradycardia, non-complex bradycardia, just sinus bradycardia with nothing else really going on, the likelihood of syncope is actually really low. So bradycardia with a low degree block, with a first degree or a second degree type 1, you're probably not going to be finding that as the cause of syncope. However, whenever you get into your high degree blocks, that's where you're going to find syncope. There are a couple of other things that I want to touch on briefly. And that's the rule of 15s. So the rule of 15s in the article that describes this as referenced in the show notes is essentially where 15% of these illnesses, these pathologies, present with syncope being the primary symptom. And that's AMIs, pulmonary emboli, AAAs, aortic dissection, ectopic pregnancies, GI hemorrhage, and subarachnoid hemorrhage. Another thing that I want to share with you guys is the San Francisco Syncope Rule, or the CHESS mnemonic. This show is all about the mnemonics. C, congestive heart failure history. H, hematocrit under 30. E, EKG abnormalities. S, shortness of breath. And then S again with the systolic blood pressure on triage of your patient under 90. And what do we tackle during this? We tackle the cardiac causes of syncope. We tackle the hypovolemic causes of syncope. Those are going to be our big problems within syncope. We've got to do a better job screening our patients. One last note here, because I know we're running over on time. It's been a long one, so my apologies. Glucose and syncope. Journal of Clinical Medicine, 2011. Only 1.9% of insulin-using diabetics experienced syncope. Not to say it doesn't cause syncope, not to say it isn't something that we should probably check. However, our syncope patients, we should probably be starting off with a 12-lead, a neuro assessment, and then going to the glucose, not the other way around. Can it be, you know, caused by hypoglycemia? Yeah, it can. But I would say that the other issue that you should probably be more cognizant of is hyperglycemia. When you have that polyuria, polydipsia, it's probably hyperglycemia that's going to be more the problem with your syncopal patients. So a few takeaways from today. Every true syncope patient needs a 12-lead. There are a ton of different cardiac causes of syncope. Pediatric syncope needs to be addressed. There's a ton of literature. The Brugada article that's referenced in the show notes demonstrates a higher correlation of increased mortality with pediatrics in syncope than adults in syncope. It's true. Syncope does have non-lethal causes. It absolutely does. There's no arguing with that. However, in pre-hospital systems and pre-hospital evaluation, we have got to do a better job evaluating our patients with syncopal episodes. We can no longer just do three leads on true syncope. That's about it for now, but I want to encourage you guys, do a good history and do a good physical exam on your syncope patients. If you have any comments, questions, concerns, gripes, moans, bitches, email us podcast.cpr@gmail.com. Comment on the show notes, cprpodcast.org/episode24. Have a good one.